Bernard Mostert is an interesting part of this whole story. 10 years ago now, he built a shoe chain on a philosophy that was simple enough to build an empire on. Just focus on shoes. It worked. Techie Town, which you'll see all around the country, grew to 220 stores and attracted the attention of one Marcus J. Uster, who in 2016, 10 years ago, did a deal with Bernard and his partner, Bram van Haestien, and bought it for 3.2 billion rand. And then Steinhoff turned out to be the biggest corporate fraud that we ever knew in South Africa. And that 3.2 billion rand was suddenly worth nil. Not surprisingly, Bernard sued. In 2021, he won back half a billion rand in cash from the Steinhoff that was there, plus a stake in Pepkor. But instead of walking away with that, being satisfied, he did it again. He rescued an organization called the House of Busby, took it out of business rescue, rebuilt it into Frontier Co. today. There are a number of brands, and not Techie Town, but Mr. Techie is in the market as well. And of course, among these brands is BizNews' longtime clothing partner, Pringle. If you go back to many years, you'll see Pringle shirts Pringle on our shirts, and you'll see the whole BizNews team has Pringle here as well. And it's really lovely to have Pringle as part of the supporters. I told you before, we love loyalty, and we also are very privileged to have Bernard finally come to the BizNews conference and have a conversation with me now about his story, about the Steinhoff interaction, and indeed where this entrepreneur is taking the organization that he has built.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth, a multi-award-winning, truly independent boutique wealth manager. Invest better with Brenthurst.
You got to tell us about that anthem, "Where the Wild Ones Go." Where you go?
Where the wild things are.
Wild things are.
It was strange. Like, you're the first person ever that asked me to give you a song. And I'm a big fan of Luke Combs. Spotify says I am in the top 0.5% of Luke Combs fans. So that was a fairly easy choice. And then that particular song, "Where the Wild Things Are," it's just a stunning song about love, loss, and a life well lived. So if you don't know it, please go and listen it. But it was kind of a random selection. So
it really is a beautiful song. I had to listen to it a few times to try and find the cut that we've had now, the 20 seconds. And I think I've become one of his fans as well. Country and Western?
Yeah.
Is that, do you do line dancing?
Steinhoff Conference 2016 was the only time that I did line dancing. And then pretty much like our Steinhoff relationship, that didn't work out too well for me. So.
Okay, so 10 years this month since you signed the deal. We know what happened. We know that the deal didn't go the way it was supposed to. But what have you learned from that? And we're going to go into lots of different angles today because this is a fireside chat. We will be taking questions about halfway through. But what did you learn there that you can share with the audience, many of whom are entrepreneurs like you, just like you, and would love to, the classification of wisdom is learning from other people's mistakes or other people's experience rather. What experiences can you share that we can all learn from, A, in the signing of the deal in the first place? Christo Visser last night said it was a handshake. Was yours a handshake as well, and would you do it again?
Look, maybe before I start, and if I go off on a tangent, just remind me of the question. But the first is I must correct you on the Techie Town founding story. It's a joke inside our grouping that I founded Techie Town. I didn't. I wasn't there at the beginning. Bram did. And Ram did it as a solo entrepreneur. And he started 1989, 20,000 rand in cash. And let's just go to the first valuation, the Actors deal we did in 2014. So 1989 to the end of 2013, that 20,000 rand, never a single cent borrowed outside of that money, grew into 1.88 billion rand. So that's 90,000 times money. And he did that by schooling us in incredibly hard ways. To this day, when he feels like working, and today it's increasingly less so, nobody can work harder than him. So I didn't find Tekkie Town, but I've been very fortunate to be associated with Bram. And I think in many ways our public personas are often mistaken. But I had a great mentor in him. And I think that's probably where the story starts for me, because I'm grateful. After all of this, I'm grateful for great mentors. And I'm particularly grateful for his mentorship. So if we then go to the sign-off transaction, and I'm, you know, this is the first interview I think I've given in the last 5 years. And probably, I hope it will be my last on sign-off. So I think you learn a lot of lessons to that point, but you actually know very little. And then you, in this world that you never imagined, and then so that's the clean year that we had inside the sign-off Pepco environment. And then we go through the litigation and the rebuilding. And all things being said, I'm very grateful for the 10 years that we've had, because we've learned so much. And probably the biggest one is that loyalty matters, but when greed walks in the door, loyalty walks out the door. And I think in that sense, we've been very fortunate that our band of brothers have been able to shelter and from that particular storm.
How do you know greed has walked in the door?
You know, so we built the business from Mosselbo first and then George. And we never did any form of benchmarking. So we didn't say, you know, what should the CEO salary be? What should the COO salary be? What rent we should pay? And we can talk a lot about that, because I think there's some interesting material that hasn't been shared before about rents and salaries, etc. But more or less this time 10 years ago, just before we signed our deal, Marcus called Bram and I to meet with him on a Friday. And this was obviously before we really understood Marcus's personality, and we just did as we were told, and we went off to Stellenbosch. And Marcus said he's discovered something very troubling to him in our deal. So we had quite a long due diligence. We had 2 years earlier been through extensive due diligence with Actis. The year before that with Old Mutual Private Equity, who ended up not doing the deal because in that year we just missed our EBITDA target. So we kind of separated. Then Actis came. And then 2 years later, I would say the most rigorous due diligence that we were subjected to were the Steinhoff due diligence, because they were in our business for almost 9 months. And when we saw Marcus on this Friday afternoon, Marcus said it never came to his attention that we all earn what he termed peanuts. So he shifted a piece of paper across the table and he said, these are your salaries now. And I think Bram went very close to cardiac arrest. And I got kind of excited. And then Bram said, no, we're not going to do this. This is because this is gluttonous. He says, you are actually stealing from people if you give people these salaries. So Marcus said, well, you guys go back and you come and tell me what we must pay you, but we can't pay you what you've been paying yourselves. And Bram and I went that night and we worked until about 2 in the morning. Actually, we debated until 2 in the morning. And ultimately, we went back with what was a suggested salary for Marcus. I was running the group at that time. I think we took 40% of the suggested salary. I think Bram took 20% of his. I think Davi was also around about the 40% mark. And there were about 14 salaries that were adjusted, and they were all adjusted upward significantly. But then Marcus also said, because you guys are not paying yourself market-related salaries, I now have to adjust the deal price, and the deal price was adjusted down. So, you know, that, so to me, and you know, salary is a very, very false sense of comfort. So, and then obviously for me, when you say when greed walks in the door, you know, we heard Christo say last night that fraud cuts through everything. And that hence the fact that that's why he can claim restitution for the lunch ruck. But nobody came to us and then said, oh, well, listen, there's fraud here. We didn't know about it. Please, will you just have your business back? Nobody did. We were outsiders. We didn't have a history of doing many deals with Marcus. We didn't put any other assets into Steinhoff. We were paying ourselves peanuts. And even after, and I think that's probably a big part of the conversation, is that with the exception of one or two incidents, we had to fight really hard to get our business back from people who from the beginning said, well, there's been a massive fraud here. And I also attribute that to the fact that people wanted to curb their losses, and that to me is also greed. And hence, people that at face value was very loyal to Marcus and did everything that he said, abandoned him very quickly. I had an outreach from a very senior Steinhoff executive who said, how do you dare go in the public and say that you've forgiven Marcus? Which Bram did, and I think we'll talk about that just now. And you guys look like fools for doing that. And it was all a big fraud. But this particular individual had been with Steinhoff for more than a decade. And before we started Frontierco, I had a little bit of time. I just litigated and had time and probably also wasn't there on the forgiveness scale yet. So I went and I researched from Sense. Nowadays it's easy. You just ask AI to do it. It does it for you. But I researched every single cent this individual made from Steinhoff, because it was all in Sense announcement and in annual disclosures. And it came to 200 million rand. Whoa. And I sent him a message back and I said, by your own admission, whatever you got from Steinhoff were the proceeds of fraud. So when you return that, you and I can have a conversation, but not until then. And it's been 10 years, but I haven't had a reply to that email. So
funny that.
Yeah.
So let's go back to the time and then we'll move forward. And you've given me two WhatsApps that you haven't disclosed before. So now we've got like the sensational thing. Let's put them up, Colin.
Before we put them up, I think there's the warning signs in terms of the cultural mismatch. Mm-hmm. Was there in what, let's call it the clean year, was there in 2016, because we went into Steinhoff, and I'll quickly tell two stories around it. And hopefully the crowd will find it at least entertaining. By that, I mean to say it should be funny, but, so the first thing is that when we went into Steinhoff, they decided to split Bram and I. So I was given Pepco Speciality, which was a very core part of our business or our business strategy. And Bram was giving the Pepco and Steinhoff property portfolio because he loves property and he's obsessed with it. So if you want to wake him up, you want to get his attention, you just say landlord and then he's there. So the first is that Bram had all 4,000 leases printed out. And he carried it in a book like a Bible with him. And he would work all hours of night or day. We'll get to that as well. And he had this system whereby one asterisk, great deal, two asterisks, fair deal, we can live with it, three asterisks, really bad deal, and four was just a WTF.
So let me understand this. 4,000 leases for all the Steinhoff properties
and
the whole group.
And the Pepco leases.
And Pepco. This is what he was responsible for. And he started working through each one of them.
Every single one with those and that full grading system. So, and when he was through it, so Bram has this strange habit of working from about 10 at night until 2 in the morning. So I also then developed the habit of kind of waking up at 1:30 and see if there's any crises. Because if I'm not answering my emails, he would phone me if it was serious enough. And often we had conversations between 1 or 2 in the morning. But I wake up to an email not addressed to me. I wake up to an email addressed to Marcus and Donnie and a few others within the fold. And I'm pretty sure if Bram had Christo's email, he would have put him in there as well. And he said, the email started like this, Mayday, Mayday, we have a crisis. He said, we must immediately put a moratorium on all leasing because there are more 3 stars and WTFs than what there are 1 stars and 2 stars. And needless to say, unlike what he was used to getting from us, he didn't get an answer by 7. So 7, he replied all to his own email and said, have you read my email? So Marcus then replied and said, Bram, we don't get into this level of detail in the group. And Bram just replied to say, maybe you should. It was clear to me.
Was that true, though, that Marcus didn't get to that level of detail, that he wasn't profiting from those really bad leases?
Marcus definitely didn't get into the leases of retail properties. That I can tell you. I never saw him get in there, but then I also really didn't see a lot of him in the period that we were within Steinhoff. So the next story, and this is probably my favorite Bram story, and he doesn't like it when I tell it, but I'm still going to risk it and tell it now, is that because we had this unique kind of culture and because it was all go, 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 we never even considered putting an out-of-office email on our emails. So we kind of disabled that feature within the all of Tekitown. So, but then when Bram becomes the head of Pepco Properties, he sends an email to one property manager who happens to be on a once-in-a-lifetime international holiday for 2 weeks. And he says, what rent are we paying in Ackerman's Tiger Valley? I get a WhatsApp, a screenshot of Bram's iPad. And Bram says in Afrikaans, check DO. Okay. So now I realize what happened is Bram has never seen an out-of-office email in his life. So I know I've got about 2 minutes to kind of land this. So I'd start typing on WhatsApp. And before I could answer, Bram sends me another WhatsApp. He says, Da donated weer. Okay. Because he replied to him and he said, in the time you took to write this email, you could have just have answered me. So I kind of realized at that stage we weren't built for a big corporate setup, and I'm grateful to be out of it today. And that was in the good year. You know, that was in good year. That's before the fraud hit and the movements, but so I think it was a big cultural mismatch.
Was it a mismatch because Steinhoff had just got that big and become just that corporate, or was it a mismatch for other reasons?
I think it was a mismatch because of, you know, kind of like our unique hillbilly way of doing things, starting point. I think people struggled to accept us there, and fairly so, you know. So I'm not trying to say that we were victims or so. Sometimes it's just not the same type of people. But then I also think a lot of people that were within Steinhoff, and probably most notably the Pepco guys, didn't want to be there. The operators didn't want to be in that setup. There's a lot of them that didn't like Marcus. Maybe a lot of them that felt that they weren't treated fairly. in the deal because reportedly quite a lot of them sold PepCor shares in the build-up to the deal. So
why didn't they like him?
I think Marcus came across as very arrogant, very bombastic. And looking back now, I think he was just a hugely insecure person. So I think he never really showed people a version that they liked. So I think it was easy to dislike him if you didn't know him.
It's many in this audience are entrepreneurs who've built their own businesses. And at some point in time, they will come to the conversations that you had at Techie Town selling it into Steinhoff. I've just read a really, really good book, and there's not many in South Africa that I term in this way, by a guy called Andrew Smith, called Handwritten, who started Yuppie Chef. And his scenario of being sold into Mr. Price, and when he arrived in Mr. Price, or when they arrived in Mr. Price, was just very similar to what you describe now, that the cultural difference was so different that the people within the organization really couldn't care about how well Yuppie Chef was going to do. It was just return on investment. And it was almost like accountants were running their lives. And he extricated himself from that. I'm not saying anything that isn't in the book. But it does appear, though, that you'd have some interesting advice for entrepreneurs like an Andrew Smith who got to the point of selling, or others sitting in this room whose businesses are now of a size where it starts becoming quite exciting to think about spending years on cruises and selling off their businesses. What would your advice to them be?
Obviously, my advice would only come from our personal experience. So if you have a business that works, you don't need cash, you don't need capital, my best advice to you is to do nothing. Look after the people that have looked after you and that you have been able to provide a job for. Pretty much like Brom did for us. And I'm glad you raised this point, because in the years that we've been building Frontierco now, we have met some phenomenal people and people that have built great businesses despite the economic challenges of our country. And one or two of them have discussed with me whether they should potentially look for a suitor, or they had outreaches. And my advice is exactly the same. I've come to know your business. I see what you're doing. I see your lifestyle. I see the freedom that you have and the time that you have with your family. So please just don't do it. And that obviously doesn't go for people that need money and that want to grow and that hasn't fully exploited their particular market opportunities. But if you're in that space, where we were, you know, before the Actis deal, Brom was 100% shareholder of Techie Town. And we were making, at that stage, about 150 million rand a year. Okay. So it would be interesting to see where we would have ended up, because that multi-brand market has moved quite a lot in the last 10 years. But my advice would always be to not do anything that compromises the thing that you've built and the people around you.
Because it's an interesting point you make there about your salaries. Often founders of businesses, entrepreneurs, take much lower salaries than they could earn in the marketplace. This is a reality of being an entrepreneur. But someone comes along and says, well, I'm going to pay you double or triple what you are earning at the moment. And for many business owners, that could be quite enticing. But the point you made that Marcus then came back and then dropped the purchase price because of your market-related salary now, meant that he might have had another intention when he engaged with you on that.
Yeah, I think so. But the truth is also, you know, that it's heartbreaking in a South African context to think about people that can start businesses and that have the ability to start them, and that get seduced by a salary 3, 4, 5 times what they would be able to pay themselves if they start out. because I think the country would be a lot better off if people could just hang on for 4, 5, 6 years until they can pay themselves the salary that is attractive to them today.
So if I follow this through to the logical conclusion, you start a business, you build it, you grow it, you then get an offer from private equity or from a corporate that wants to buy you out. Don't be seduced by the short-term benefits. Rather look at what the compounding effect would be on where you've come to at that point, not just compounding effect financially, but in a lifestyle sense as well.
Definitely, yeah. And you know, I think, and it would be interesting to talk about that at some stage with people from the crowd, because I think there's a lot of businesses like that in this particular crowd, is that when somebody else puts their hand on your business and start changing it, it actually changes what you've built. And in that sense, you lose the thing that you've created. So, you know, in a way, Bram lost all of what he built by the fact, by the sign of fraud. But I think there are people out there that lose all of what they've built because they've did a perfectly good deal and they are shunted from their own business. And I think in a different way, you personally have some history there. So I think you understand it better than most.
If that hadn't happened, we wouldn't have BizNews. So, you know, sometimes God's got a plan.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about God's plan, because of all of those people that Marcus Uster crossed swords with, not the people who worked for him necessarily, but elsewhere, when he fell from grace, they were quick to put the boot in. And yet, on your side, you had been defrauded. You hardly knew the guy, and you decided to forgive him. Well, I say you, I'm talking about you and Bram together. That to me, and I think to many people in South Africa, was, oh, there must be something else behind the scenes.
It's maybe a good time to put up the WhatsApps.
Colin, could you do that? Could you put up, not that one, the WhatsApps?
I love that one, though.
So let's just, perhaps while we're waiting for the guys to do that, the sequence of events was, these WhatsApps were sent on the 4th of December. When was the explosion, the Steinhoff explosion? We're talking 2017.
Pretty much around then. When Marcus resigned.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that was the 7th.
Yes.
So this was just before the resignation.
Yeah. And let me say this before we go into that, because Bram kind of immediately and unreservedly, before he even knew what happened, forgave Marcus. And we'll see that when the WhatsApps come on. But I do believe that for the balance of us, that forgiveness only came later as we understood more. And then there is it's not only forgiving Marcus. It's actually over time, forgiveness is actually a very selfish thing, because you only feel better. You feel better about yourself, certainly, if you do it. And the absence of bitterness allows you to be more productive, more focused, etc. So, yes, we did forgive Marcus, but we also have forgiven everybody that played a role in obstructing us and trying to get in the way of us trying to get our business back. You know, so, and there I can go to some examples. You know, I said earlier that we were outsiders. We were outsiders before the deal, and we were outsiders after the deal. We were outsiders in the settlement. We, at first, they wanted to pay us 7 cents in the rand for our deal. For our claim, then it became 10 cents in the rand. And we'll talk about that representation always came from Steinhoff. So at the time, it came from Louis de Pre and Theodore Clark, who.
So the lawyers who were then running Steinhoff.
Who were running Steinhoff, yeah.
Corpse.
So, I mean, that was the offer that was made to us formally, even though very little attention was paid to us. But so I say we forgive them, you know, but we also forgive the PepCo guys that went into a warehouse that we owned and ripped all the shelving out from top to floor, that went into every office and cut every IT cable. So when we got the building back in 2020, we had to re-rig the whole building and we had to put back 17 million rands worth of shelving. I think some of that PepCo shelving is still for sale somewhere in Joel.
Sure. So there is the WhatsApp. I'm going to read it because it might be a little small. But this came on the 4th of December 2017. Remember, just before the Steinhoff explosion. Aye Obram, I tell you what, I'll read in Afrikaans, you can interpret in English. Aye Obram, ek voel seker na Christus die kakste teenoor jou. This is Marcus writing. What does that mean?
I feel, after Christus, I feel the worst towards you.
Ek sal jou nooit, capitals, weer in die oor kan kyk nie.
I won't be able to look you in the eyes.
Ek weet nie hoe om jammer te sê nie.
I don't know how to apologize.
And then shortly thereafter he says, hallo, eerstens wil ek om verskoning maak vir al die slechte pers wat ek om Steinhoff gebring het die laaste paar maande.
I want to apologize for all the bad press that, and that was about the fact that they couldn't get the audits released or published. So.
Tweedens het ek nou groot skade veroorsaak deur nie die jaar se geauditeerde state afgehandel te kon kry nie en ek het groot foute gemaak wat tot nou groot skade vir baie onskuldige.
So there he says he has caused big damage to a lot of people.
By not being able to get the audited results across. And then on the 4th of 12th, he says, dankie vir die ondersteuning en vriendskap.
Yeah, so Bram called him. Bram called him and said, well, I don't know what's going on. And Bram was on Ben Lagrancy's case from earlier in November.
Ben Lagrancy?
The former CFO who's now in jail. And I think Ben is the only South African imprisonment to date. And we also, at some stage, need to talk about that. You know, so we've got the biggest fraud in South African history, and we've got almost zero convictions. So is there a possibility for it to happen again? Because it seems like you can get away with it. Yes, but I mean, we'll get back to that. So Bram phoned him, and then I think there's another series of WhatsApps that happened the following day. I don't know if the guys can put it up.
Just to finish off that series of WhatsApp. Dankie vir jou ondersteuning en vriendskap. Thank you for your support and friendship. En ek is jammer oor al hierdie kak. I am sorry about all this shit.
You're quite good at interpreting, Alan.
Ek wou dit nie so gehad het nie. I didn't want it to happen this way. I just wanted to save you having to swear.
So,
all right, on to the next set of WhatsApps, and these have not been seen before, so thank you very much for doing this for us. There's a question mark, Merle Point question mark, which clearly was the, not Marcus, was...
So Bram asked him, where is he? And he says, are you in Merle Point? Marcus said, by the way, where did you think you are? Because at that stage, some people thought that he had fled the country. So there was a theory that it was Argentina or whatever, but he had now disappeared off the radar. Obviously didn't pitch up for the day that he had to face the auditors. That was when his resignation came through. And then I can't read the green from here with my glasses. So.
Dankie, and he said, dankie Bram, ek het sy genade nodig.
Okay, so that he says, I need God's grace.
And then Bram responds, he says, bel my asseblief, sterkte, die Heere is lief vir jou.
Bram says, please call me and God, Jesus loves you.
Baie dankie, says Marcus, ek moet nou my familie gaan face, ek bel jou later.
Okay, so at this stage, he obviously hasn't even seen his family, so he needs to go tell his family that what's happening.
And so Bram gets back to him and says, nee, moet asseblief nie verskoning maak nie. Ek weet toevallig waar jy is. Ek is naby jou. Ek en die manne is fyn.
So Bram says, don't worry about me and my men. And that turned out to be a very true assessment because we did turn out to be fine.
kan ek na jou toe kom net om vir jou te sê ek gee nie 'n moer om. That's a bad word. You don't have to say that. Om wat jy verkeerd gedoen het nie. Ek wil deur dik en dun jou vriend wees.
Yeah. So I don't give a what you did. Please can I come see you? I don't care what you did, and I want to be your friend through thick and thin. And that goes a little bit to our loyalty conversation of earlier.
And Marcus's response was, genoeg bedoel ek.
Yeah, and then what happened subsequently is that Marcus then came to see Bron the same day. And Bron says, I wasn't there, but Bron says that was the most defeated that he's ever seen a human being. And Marcus was crying, and he repeated that he can't look him in the eyes. And Bram said, the book that I live by says 70 times 7. And
what 70 times 7?
To forgive 70 times 7. You know, so, and I know in a way that is contradictory to what Christo said last night, because Christo says he can't get to forgive him. And unto each his own. But as I said, we over time had to forgive quite a lot of people, and we found that that's actually a good thing, just in terms of allowing you to move on.
But if you now look back at this personality, clearly there was a personality disorder that Marcus Yoster had. Some would even term it sociopathy, maybe psychopathy. Are you still comfortable that the right way to treat sociopaths or psychopaths is to forgive?
I don't think we could be selective about forgiveness, but I think we can put ourselves out of harm's way. And that's why I said earlier to people, please don't sell your businesses if you don't need to. But it's also not only the sociopaths that you have to forgive, it's everybody that then worked against you, because there were many. I'm very happy with where we are on it, and not from a biblical sense or a moral sense. I'm happy from an inner peace perspective, because I think it can live inside you like a cancer, and it's not worthwhile. So, and then the other thing, of course, Alec, is that this notion that this was the work of one man and that single-handedly created it. And I mean, let's just be honest about that. That's nonsense. And in the unguarded way, that's bullshit. There's a lot of people that knew. And the lack of charges and the lack of convictions tell us that it wasn't ever fully investigated or prosecuted.
You know, just after it all collapsed, and I knew a lot of people in the organization because of the work that I did, one of the guys phoned me and said, or he was shocked, he said, but where's the 17th floor? And what he meant by that was Bernie Madoff was the face of the fraud, but he had a whole bunch of people working on the 17th floor to enable the fraud of the Madoff scandal.
Correct, yes. His children didn't know. His children was on the 16th floor down, and he had this team on the 17th floor. Yes,
so correct. Where's the 17th floor? Do you have any theories about where the 17th floor is in the Steinhoff issue?
No, I don't, because the only 17th floor I ever went to was that office where our salaries were cut, and that office was surrounded by offices of people that today cast stones and that want to disassociate it with him. But I look at the level of interaction and the level of detail, and I say, you have this personality. We can talk about how insecure he was, sure. You look at this personality and how controlling and domineering he was. And then I say, would he keep this with what has worked for him secret from everybody else? I don't buy that. I don't think he did it on his own. And I don't think he had a small group of external people that helped him hoodwink his whole organization.
It sounds like these were really nasty, ugly people. And I say this because another conversation that we had, part of the conversation last night with Christo, was about this fellow Malcolm King, who was his face, his front. Malcolm King was 80 when he died. As Christo shared, and as we put onto Biz News a while ago, he had called in a prostitute and her pimp, who clearly is an 80-year-old, and she, I don't think this woman is much over 30, had then been in a position to poison his drink and kill him and take, I mean, it doesn't sound like a fine, upstanding human being that is your face to the public. Indeed, the guy who supposedly owns Lanzarach, and we know that wasn't the case. So if that's the kind of 17th floor occupant, these people are probably laughing at people like you for saying, well, you know, you forgive us, yay.
Well, listen, there's lots of people that laugh. That's fine, because, I mean, it's a, so be it. And we continue to write our story. I never met Malcolm. And so I can't comment on him. And we'll talk about Rassi a little bit later, but in a conversation that we had with Rassi, he said that we often forget that every single person carries something that we know nothing about. Now, it looks in the case of Malcolm as if it was kind of dark, for what we could say. But beyond that, I can't really comment because I don't know him. And what would it matter if I judge him or comment him? Anyway?
I'm not talking about a judgment at all on Malcolm or on any other human being. I'm just saying that, hang on, here's the biggest fraud ever in South African history. There were hundreds of billions that was wiped out. You felt the sharp end of it. And yet there are many who must have been involved. He couldn't have done it on his own. And we've had one conviction. So it doesn't seem right. It seems as, where does the fault lie that at least it hasn't been investigate or bring the guys to court and let them have their say?
So let's do a little bit of scenarios around that. So the first is, and this is just the information that I got from AI in preparing for our talk today. I think in total there's been 6 convictions globally, of which one has been in South Africa. I think if you tally up all the prison sentences and you make allowance for good time, etc., the people that went to prison or will go to prison, or obviously I can't talk for those that will still go to prison, they will have spent 6 years in total serving for this crime. Is that an acceptable penalty? Is that something that will deter you from doing this again if you're thinking that you need to cut a corner? Because I can tell you what I learned from Marcus over time, and with the benefit of 10 years worth of hindsight, I can tell you that Marcus was hugely insecure. Hugely. That he was a big people pleaser, and he did things to make other people happy. Mm-hmm. I think along the way, he became wealthy himself. And I think that fueled ego. And I think that turned out to be a very, very dangerous cocktail. But the scenario that I was talking about earlier is that during the time that Marcus was supportive of Yanni Mouton and fending off Naspers, etc., not a deal that I know that well, Marcus accumulated quite a lot of PSG shares, which he then transferred along with others and converted it into Stanoff shares. If Marcus didn't do that, if Marcus didn't move those shares into Stanoff and didn't lose all of that, he would have had the means to defend himself for decades. And, you know, it's obviously very difficult to make a call as to why he committed suicide. But personally, I'm convinced that he committed suicide because he didn't want to face the humiliation of an arrest the next day, and he had run out of money completely to defend himself. So he doesn't do the PSG deal. We could still be having this conversation about when is Marcus going to be charged, because he was quite successful in delaying prosecution until that point.
Well, that was the day after the FSCA had the 475 million rand fine on him. But that timing, did you have any idea that he was going to commit suicide? Did he show you anything?
No, but then I also hadn't spoken to him for about 6 weeks at that time. So it's there was a time when we had a fair amount of casual conversation, checking in, how are you, etc. But no, at that stage I didn't. Brahm was in America and he heard it and he actually phoned me and said that Marcus just committed suicide. And I think we were among the first people to know. And so there was no inclination from my side, but I knew that all his resources had run dry.
I spoke to his advocate or his attorney who handled the whole way around that time. And he told me that they had a flight booked to Johannesburg, 6 o'clock that evening, and that Marcus had agreed to him that they would go along to, I think it was the Hawks.
Hand in his passport. That's it.
Sign the confession and then come home.
No, he would have appeared the next day.
And then come home after that. So he would have done they were going to stay overnight. And so it wasn't like he was going straight to jail or anything. He was just having to admit to something that all along he hadn't admitted to. Was that the breaking point that he just wasn't prepared to admit that he'd done wrong?
No, I think possibly there was a notion or a fear, but as I said, I didn't speak to him, is that he would actually be imprisoned then and that there would be a bail hearing and that might take some time, etc. So that's the only conclusion I can get to, is that time and money had run out. So
it is difficult always that people are complex and you were much closer than most. Let's get to the Hermanus house, which recently sold for 105 million. We had a conversation on BizNews TV about the mortgage that you granted or you had over the property. How did that come about? And, you know, just tell us through that story. And are you relieved now that it's finally been sold?
Very, very. So, you know, at first, so Marcus didn't offer us a property. He actually probably raised the issue of buying the Yonkershoek properties where they lived, with a number of Steinhoff executives at properties.
The where, sorry?
The Yonkershoek behind Lazarus. Yeah. Okay. So Marcus's primary residence, and Donnie lived there and Fricky lived there. So
the Hermanus house, which takes up almost a whole block, was not his primary residence.
No, not at all. I thought you knew this.
I did not.
No, he lived right behind the Landrecht in a very expensive property.
So all those graffiti guys who were writing Marcus Issa, they were actually attacking the wrong place. He didn't see that.
I think at the stage when they started doing that, he was living in Hermanus.
Okay.
Because the Yonkershoek properties were sold in, to this day, a fairly uncontroversial deal to a group of people that included quite a lot of Steinhoff insiders. So that's where the Yonkershoek properties went. And I think it's subsequently, there's been more properties developed there. I haven't followed it. But so that was the first reach out. And I always wonder, if we ended up buying that property, would it have been as uncontroversial as what it was? The Hermanus property came up. Rian du Plessis approached us. I think, like, Brahm is not the Hermanus guy, and he's also not a Stellenbosch guy, so he didn't really want a property. But when we looked at it, we said, well, this has got very good security over it. It's got a bond. We can extend that bond, and in that way, possibly we can get the property over time, should we want it, and execute on it. And that turned out not to happen. So we bought the bond. We were fortunate to recover pretty much what we were owed and the interest on.
So did Marcus not stay in Hermanus?
No, he did. He did.
So where? How does it? The Yonkershoek was his primary residence until 2017. Is that what?
Yeah, I think until about 2019.
And he then went to Amanus and decided on the day that he'd had enough, went down to the seaside and took his own life. There are people in Amanus who believe he's still alive.
Unfortunately so, yes. And that he is actually in Argentina, but he is very much not with us anymore.
How do you know that?
I know it because of your good journalism, because you were on the scene, right?
I was, the next morning.
You were on the scene the next morning, and that couldn't have been a nice thing to do at any level, A, to see it, and B, I think people probably criticized you for doing it, but it's good journalists don't worry about being criticized, and we appreciate that you did that.
Well, I appreciate Eric from HPP, who was just a guy walking past and gave me the whole story of how they found the body. So there was no question about it, and phoned it in, reported it in. Let's move on to a much happier issue for the end of this conversation. But thanks for opening up with us. I'm sure we appreciate getting an insight into a story that for many is still a mystery, and you've now uncovered a lot of that. But
and if we have time to take questions, because I would hate to walk off and then people say we didn't have a chance.
You know what we're going to do with the questions? Because the fireside, you don't usually have questions. But they will be on the WhatsApp group. And if you are happy to go onto it and to answer the questions.
I am on the WhatsApp group.
Exactly. So you can then pick up those questions. I just want to talk about South Africa's number one hero, the man we all love more than any other. Even if Madiba was alive, it'd be a close race. Rossie Rosmus. How did you get involved with him?
This is a lekker story. But can we just quickly talk about President Mandela? Because I think the forgiveness point is also critical. If he didn't come out of prison with a heart that was open to forgiveness and forward-looking, we wouldn't be sitting here about having this conversation or about new political parties, etc., because the scorched earth policy would have been in place a long time ago. So I think there's something to be said for that. Then, in terms of Rossie, we noticed on social media that Rossie was wearing a lot of Pringle. And we couldn't figure out how the product got to him. But because obviously we liked the fact that he was wearing it a lot, we sent him some more before we knew him, or his mentor and good friend Frikkie Rosmus. And it turned out that Rossie just loves the brand Pringle, and he went into our Canal Walk store and he bought it. And our staff seemingly was so oblivious to the fact that this is a big thing that they entertained him 3 or 4 times without telling us. Well, Rossie came in and he bought 5 t-shirts and 3 jerseys today, And since then, it has kind of formalized slightly more, because he wears Pringle as a standard now. And this week, I call him our chief architect of promise, chief architect of possibility. So this week we're launching, really at the public's request, a Rossie range that starts with a cap that reads "In Your Head," which we hope people will wear when we face our greatest foe in the next month.
Colin, would you mind bringing that up, please? It's in your head. Isn't that brilliant?
Sure.
And the relationship with him, have you found him to be as wise a person as we seem to believe he is from the bit that we from the outside have seen?
Fascinating. Fascinating human being. Completely the opposite to the Marcus Ruiz that we discussed earlier. Works incredibly hard. Just loves to talk about rugby. We've had him on our farm a few times now. And he's really, really obsessed with two things. He's obsessed with rugby, and he's obsessed with the impact that it has on South Africa. And I think the quote we've got up here is to say, it's easy to give up. If you do this for yourself, the moment you do it with other people, it's difficult to give up.
Yeah.
And that rings very true for me in terms of what we went through with the Steinel thing. But there's a funny story, when we did the formal photo shoot for Pringle about 3 weeks ago, for the launch of our collaboration with him, we asked him if we could do some quick fire questions, just, you know, casually at the end. And he was reluctant. And he said, well, he doesn't really like it because you're not prepared. And then what if he says something that's not like, and we said, well, if you don't like the question, just say pass. So, but he then never said pass. And the one question that came up was South Africans are, and without blinking, he said, fucking tough. And I think that's a message that we could take to heart. I think that's the oddest message for all of us, because what we're listening to here is after years of struggle, we are still tough and we're marching forward, you know, all of us.
Where are you going? Where are you going from your business, from your life, from yourself? You live in George, so you're not in the big smokes, any of them. You've got, just as a kind of parting shot.
I must say, we've learned a lot in the last 10 years, and personally, I've also learned a lot. And, you know, one of the quotes that you will see from Rassie is, which also relates very strongly to me, is to say that moments of difficulty doesn't build character, it only reveals it. And I hope one day when my kids look back, and my family look back, they will say that when things were really tough, I managed to keep my head and not get distracted and not get sucked in. And that I was a loyal friend and a loyal family member, and that's our story. But where do we go? So I love the fact that we ended up staying in George. I don't like the fact that Techie Town moved and a lot of people lost their jobs in the process. I feel sorry for them. It is still something that I feel deep down we could have prevented if we that kind of stayed the course. But genuinely, truly love George, love having grown up there, love what it offers, and love everything our family can do from there. And in terms of Frontierco, you know, it's a small business, so I don't mean to say, and people build it like you guys have built a great thing again, but we're busy building it. We took about 70 million rand and put that into those assets to start off with. And I think that 70 million rand, well, I know the 70 million rand has been paid back now. And we're sitting just north of a billion rand's worth of turnover. So, you know, we're at it. And it's fun.
Would you list it?
No.
Would you recommend to any of the people who are thinking of listing their companies to do so?
No, I think there are businesses and people that are well suited to that capital market. Yes, absolutely. But not us, because the 2 o'clock emails don't really translate that well in a listed environment.
Bernard, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
I mean, thank you.
This BizNews production is brought to you by Brenthurst Wealth. The wealthy aren't leaving South Africa, but their trusts are moving offshore. Invest better with Brenthurst. Start your day a step ahead. BizNews Insider. It delivers the business stories that matter every morning straight to your inbox. Sharp, fast, and free. Subscribe now.